Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. A stay-at-home order is in place. Medical equipment is hard to find. There is an illness causing flu-like symptoms, and it spreads easily. The year? 1918. And in Charlotte, everything is closed. Schools are closed. Businesses are closed. Movie theaters are closed. So what's open? Grocery stores and pharmacies. The 1918 flu pandemic has reached the Queen City, and although the Charlotte of that year was 1/20th the size we are today, Charlottesians struggled as life as they knew it came to a grinding halt. There are many, many parallels to the COVID-19 pandemic we're living through today, including anxiety about reopening things like the economy. The flu hit Charlotte in the autumn of 1918, but by the beginning of 1919, some businesses sued the local Board of Health for keeping them from making a profit, all while 13,000 North Carolinians succumbed to the virus and 500,000 Americans also lost their lives. They say, if you don't know history, you are doomed to repeat it. So what can we learn from our ancestors and their experience if we thumb through the pages of history? Let's find out. And fortunately for us, we don't have to thumb through any pages because Dr. Lauren Austin wrote her doctoral dissertation on this topic. It's called Afraid to Breathe, Understanding North Carolina's Experience of the 1918-1919 Influenza Pandemic at the State, Local, and Individual Levels. And she joined us in April of last year as the nation was first adjusting to the harsh realities of the pandemic. I asked Lauren, when did she first start writing her dissertation, and why did this topic specifically interest her?
I started writing it late 2016, and most of it was written in 2017. It was part of a larger project. My chair, Dr. William Brandon, and I were asked to write a chapter about North Carolina's history of public health for an anthology, and we did. And the flu information was so interesting that we were asked to write a separate chapter on the influenza pandemic, and it kind of snowballed into a dissertation. And I'm grateful it did, because it was fascinating.
The world of 1918, it's so different from how we live today, 102 years later. Public health, how would you describe the state of public health back then?
In North Carolina, it was basically non-existent. So we still had, most people still used outside toilets. We were far behind a lot of other states, most other states, in our disease mortality rates. We were ahead of them. So we were behind in our health measures. We were struggling a little bit. We didn't have a standardized public health system. Mm-hmm.
Even in the cities like Charlotte and Raleigh and Durham, they didn't have anything approaching what we have today?
Not what we had today, okay. No. Wow. They were more likely to report, but North Carolina then was largely rural. So right. It was...
And that's one of the things that you ran across while you did this dissertation, is that it's hard to come up with concrete numbers, real hard, fast numbers on a lot of things, because A, the numbers weren't collected, and in many cases, even if they were collected, they weren't reported. Right.
We had I found a lot of situations where communities only had one doctor, and that doctor may have been called up to war. So whoever was filling in was trying to fill in for many areas, and recording just fell to the wayside. So what we have is what we have, but probably not all there was.
So you didn't set out to do this necessarily, but it's turned out that your dissertation is generally acknowledged to be the most exhaustive study of the flu pandemic of 1918 in this state, and the most comprehensive source of local information about that pandemic. How did you do the research? What documents did you look at? Where did you find them?
For the first section, I mainly used death certificates filed, and I accessed those actually from my computer at home from the State Board of Health. It was great. I went through, due to time restrictions, I just looked at October 1918 and March 1919, given the peak and the end. Okay. So that could give us a good view of the whole cycle. But even then, that meant coding, hand coding 12,000 death certificates individually to create this database.
And we're going to explore what you discovered here and what happened in 1918 and look at some of the parallels between then and now. But before we get in too deep, I'm just curious, knowing what you know as you research that pandemic and you're living through this one, what strikes you as the most interesting or striking or the parallel that just leaps off the page for you?
I think people's reaction to it. It's so similar regarding how people are initially scared, and it quickly turned into boredom and frustration. And that's, I saw the same thing in 1918. People were scared in late September and early October, but by as early as mid to late October, I saw letters to family and friends saying, I'm bored. I just want to go out. I want to go hang out with friends and have a party. And it's the same thing.
As I was reading that yesterday, it struck me that if they wanted to go out, where was there to go? I mean, seriously, Charlotte then versus Charlotte today is a very different place. What could they have done if they went out besides have an ice cream social, perhaps?
I think they were talking about, I remember one lady was wishing she could go get a cold drink. She just wanted a cold drink, and she was very frustrated she couldn't do that.
Okay. There are those who have tried to give the name to this outbreak, this COVID-19 outbreak, the Chinese virus, because it came out of China, allegedly. We think it did. The 1918 flu was called the Spanish flu. It did not come out of Spain. Spain had nothing to do with it. How did it get that name then?
Unfortunately for Spain, they were, the pandemic actually started in the spring of 1918. It started to spread across Europe, given the war situation. And every country in Europe was censoring their newspapers because of the war, except for Spain. So Spain was the only country to start asking questions and asking other countries, are you having the same experience, and not wanting to signal weakness in any way. Most countries denied they were having a problem. So it looked as though Spain was the only country having an issue with it. So it became known as the Spanish influenza. But of course, Spain had nothing to do with it.
And it's pretty easy to understand how COVID-19 spread across the world so quickly, because we live in an age where you can get from one part of the globe to another in a matter of hours. And people, vast numbers of people, traveled a lot. How did the 1918 flu pandemic spread so quickly? Because there was no air travel, and people crossing the Atlantic spent a month on a boat almost to get here. How did it spread so quickly?
It was a perfect storm, because we were involved in World War I, and researchers think that it started at Camp Funston in Kansas in the early spring of 1918. And
why Kansas? That's in the middle of the country. Why Kansas?
It's amazing how these things just start. It could be just a fluke interaction between a human and an animal, and a new strain of influenza is born, and off it goes.
So stop. Are you saying that the actual 1918 flu may have started for the world in Kansas, or just here in this country in Kansas?
For the world.
For the world?
Mm-hmm.
So it's the American flu.
It might be the American flu.
That's wild. So from an animal to a human and then on, and we were in the middle of a war. So you mentioned it's a military base. It was a military base.
So we were shipping people and goods out over to Europe. So it went overseas. It started to spread. And that early round in the spring of 1918 was not the same strain that came back through in the fall. It was milder, more like your average flu, but there were signs that it was more deadly, because you had the pneumonia quickly picking up, and that's something that's a little odd with flu.
Yeah, COVID-19 is not a flu. It is some other kind of virus. And I don't know whether coronaviruses can mutate the way the flu virus does and continues to do. And as you mentioned, however it started is not how it finished. It got stronger as time went on. And maybe this will happen with the COVID-19 virus. We don't know. But what made that flu in 1918 so much worse, because they'd had flus down through time. What made that so much worse? Was it simply such a brand new flu like COVID-19 that they had no immunity to it whatsoever?
It was a particular mutation of the strain. And the people who had it in 1918 are thought to have developed an immunity of some sort to the later strain in 1918. Okay. So in the spring, you had the elderly population coming down with it and largely recovering. But then when it came back, because it came back to America from the war ships. So when it came back in September, it was a mutated strain that largely targeted young adults, which is a population that is not normally targeted. Usually you have infants and the elderly populations being targeted. Yeah. But this particular strain seemed to target young adults, and it would kill them in a day, if not hours.
Wow. This flu, the 1918 flu, spread around the world. But in 1918, then Secretary of the Navy, Franklin Roosevelt, caught it. President Woodrow Wilson came down with it in the same year, along with author John Steinbeck. These are all famous people. Actress Lillian Gish, comedian Groucho Marx got that flu, along with Walt Disney. And this lasted until 1919, or actually the end of 1920, I read it, mm-hmm. it ended. So it went on for a long time. Were precautions on containing the spread in place for most of that time, or did they vary from place to place, or did they come and go as time went on?
They varied. You had some small cities who saw a problem and immediately shut down. They restricted any incoming travel. They basically quarantined the whole town, and they tended to do fine. Then you had cities, larger cities like Charlotte. They tried to make quarantine measures, but at the state level, the governor knew he couldn't enforce anything on that scale. He didn't have the resources. He could only suggest. It was up to local boards of health to make those decisions. And when they tried to close businesses, to restrict the economy like they did, they were met with a lot of backlash, like now.
Like now. I want to come back to that because that's one of the parallels I think we can learn something from. But none of the famous people that I just mentioned who got the 1918 flu succumbed to it. They all survived it and got better. What was the ratio of deaths to those who came down with this flu who later recovered? And once people came down with it, how long did it take to recover when they did?
I don't really know the exact ratio because the numbers are so loosely reported. And a lot of times it was reported as pneumonia. But what would generally happen would be 20% of the people who got this flu, it was a normal flu for them, just like you would have the flu today and recover. The other 80%, one of two things happened. They either caught this immediate quick strain and they would basically drown. Their lungs would drown them in a matter of hours. Or like Woodrow Wilson, they would have it and be very sick and then they would eventually recover, but they were lethargic and sluggish mentally.
I want to come back to that too. But we have to take a break. Dr. Lauren Austin's with us. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the 1918 flu pandemic that affected Charlotte and all of North Carolina and most of the world back then, and looking for parallels between what's happening here and how they handled it then and how we're handling the COVID-19 outbreak today. Dr. Lauren Austin wrote a dissertation on this topic, which has been come to be called or considered the most exhaustive study on the pandemic and the most comprehensive source of local information about what happened in 1918. She is a quality control editor at Research Square. That's an academic editing company at UNC Charlotte. Your dissertation, doctor, is called Afraid to Breathe. Where did the title come from?
It actually came from a letter I found written by a young man, and he was remembering the pandemic, and he was talking about how in early October, everyone was scared to go outside. They were scared to talk to people. They were scared to do anything. And he actually said they were afraid to breathe.
Did that come from the fact that medical science and knowledge, common knowledge of medical science, was much less then than it is today, and they really didn't know how this virus spread, kind of like the AIDS epidemic? People were very afraid of it in the beginnings because they just didn't know how it was being spread.
They had some right and some wrong back in 1918. They knew that close contact, sneezing, coughing, they kept warning people against letting people spit on you, which I didn't realize was a huge problem. But some of the advice they would give was a little bizarre. Looking back on it, you had to wonder what they were thinking. But, sleeping with all your windows open and as many blankets as possible was supposed to be good to keep the influenza away. But they had some right, some very wrong. But they were doing the best they could. They knew not to share utensils. They were telling people not to do that, which was common practice back then.
Well, I want to. You mentioned the word spit. Not a word we utter very often on the radio.
No.
But North Carolina Governor Thomas Bickett issued a statement on October 3rd, 1918, advising North Carolinians, quote, "The disease is due to spit swapping. Spit is swapped or exchanged by coughing or sneezing into the air instead of a handkerchief." We would just call that droplets today.
Right.
We're more polite. He talked about how far that invisible spray could travel in the air and how long it could linger. And he had these words of caution. And I want you, maybe you can shed some light on this, because I'm not sure what he's saying here. But he says, quote, "A great many soda fountains maintain a small collection of water practically hidden beneath the counter or slab where the spit germs of the town are pooled and redistributed." Was he talking about people sitting on one side of the counter just having a conversation, and the droplets that would come from their mouths would then fall onto glassware that was behind the counter? What was he talking about there?
Partly that, and partly that they restaurants, any establishment, didn't have the health requirements that we do now. So they didn't necessarily wash the cups out great in between users. That's why the governor was encouraging people to ask for a paper cup, even though it would cost you more.
Yes, even if it cost more.
Because you would pay a premium for having your own cup versus using one that had been previously used 10 minutes before.
I think it's just the opposite today. You can't get coffee in a China cup because they don't want to have to maintain the health standards, so they give it to you in your own one-time use only cardboard cup.
Exactly.
In 1918, the North Carolina State Board of Health advised, quote, "Keep away from crowds. Avoid people who cough, sneeze, or spit. Do not use common drinking cups or towels." One of the things that they mentioned was don't use those roller towels that used to be in bathrooms. You just pulled it down and washed your hands on them or dried your hands on. Keep the bowels open. Why did they think that was important?
They were big on that piece of advice.
And what does that mean?
Daily enemas, and it was a bad situation for people who followed that piece of advice. They thought that if your body was working well in all regards, then you would be less likely to catch.
They also advised to snuff Vaseline up your nose 3 times a day. Was that to keep the nasal passages clogged so nothing could go up there?
Catch the germs. Yes.
Gargle with warm salt water, keep in the open air and sunshine, and sleep with the windows open. Now, this was October, November, December. Mm-hmm. Wash your hands before eating. Well, now there's something we have in common from 1918. And never put unwashed hands in your mouth. These are from the State Health Department.
Some of those were new suggestions.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Always bow the head and cover your nose and mouth with a handkerchief.
Yes.
Is that their primitive form of a mask? Is that what that was about?
It was, but I think it was to keep those droplets from spreading. And then you see in some pictures that the face masks were being used back then. A lot of cities, I don't think Charlotte was one of them. I know in San Francisco, they require people to wear masks before they even let them on the trolleys. So people were starting to use them back then.
I just read these. Some of these could be change the word spit into something else, and it's the same instruction that we're being given today. Mm-hmm. Cover your mouth. Don't sneeze. You know, you sneeze into your elbow. In 100 years from now, will our descendants look back on these instructions for the COVID-19 virus as being as, I guess, antique as these appear?
You would think, but once you look back at 1918, you realize that when you read through the ones that aren't great, there are the tips are the same. I think a lot of the base recommendations we have today are going to hold, because that will always be a way that diseases like the flu spread through coughing and sneezing. And
now, the flu is a virus. Back in 1918, did they even know the word virus? Did they know what caused a flu?
They knew that it was spread by germs, but they hadn't really broken down, you know, that the bacteria or the viral components of it.
Until COVID-19 came our way a couple months ago, the 1918 influenza pandemic was the most severe pandemic in recent history. It had a high mortality rate, as you mentioned, in people younger than 5. Those from 20 to 40, and those 65 and older. And that's a vast swath. It pretty much includes almost everybody except teenagers, but it's a vast swath of the population. Do we know why, like teenagers and people from 50 to 65 were not as severely affected? Do we have any idea at all?
For the older population, it's suspected that those individuals had survived another milder pandemic back in, I think, the 1870s.
Okay.
So they had some sort of immunity to this strain that protected them a little bit. But what was interesting is that by March 1919, the flu had mutated again, and it had mutated in a way that the elderly were now more at risk again. So it kept changing.
So as you read articles in newspapers, and I know you read letters from people that something we don't do anymore is write letters, but you read personal letters as people expressed their own private thoughts in these letters. Were they as afraid of the flu virus at the time as we, as many people today, are afraid of the COVID-19 virus? How would their reactions compare to our reactions today?
They're similar. I think in some ways they were a little more frightened because their news source was a lot slower. They had to rely mainly on newspapers, and sometimes people lived in areas where they didn't get the large city newspapers. So they had to rely on word of mouth. They had to, and the news they got was sometimes days old. So they were scared because a lot of times they didn't know what was really happening elsewhere.
So when did the 1918 flu present? When did we first become aware that there was a flu pandemic?
When it came back for the second round in late September, I think it was September 23rd, 1918, it landed in Wilmington. Within a week, people knew it was something different.
And how what was the interval between the time North Carolinians knew that they had a problem within the state with this pandemic versus when it actually presented in the world at large? Do you know? You may not know.
Well, it was about the same time, really.
Okay.
As far as I know, when it started here late September, and by October 3rd, you had that statement from the governor saying that there is an outbreak. He called it the normal influenza, which was not correct.
Right.
But they knew there was a widespread problem.
So it presented in Wilmington. Is that because Wilmington's a port city and it came in on a boat, on a ship?
Yes. Mm-hmm. It came in on a military ship.
And then once it got to North Carolina, how did it spread from the coast to the mountains? Because it did. Was it along the railway stops? Was it in some other? Can you trace the geographical spread of it, I guess, is the question.
I did trace the spread of it in my dissertation because it was largely suspected that it did spread over the train lines, but that's not what I found. I found that it was concentrated more in the railway hubs and the large cities and spread from there. So it didn't trace along the actual railway lines, but it kind of spread out from the major hub cities. But,
and of course, Charlotte had Camp Green, which was a military a training base for World War I. Did that exacerbate or increase our chances or increase the incidence of cases that we got here?
It had to have impacted in several ways, but I know that early on, the Army, they quarantined Camp Green. They weren't, right. The soldiers were not allowed to go into town without special permission. So
it hits Wilmington in September of 1918. When did it arrive in Charlotte?
Quickly. Within a couple of weeks.
And how long after it hit Charlotte did it take for the city to start closing down? Because we did close down schools. We did shutter businesses and movie theaters and restaurants. How long did it take to make that decision?
By mid-October, you had things starting to close. Schools, churches starting to close down. Businesses.
So not unlike COVID-19. It was pretty quick.
It was quick. Cool. The leaders knew that there was a problem, and they realized that it was a different kind of problem than they had seen before.
So essentially, they enacted their own version of social distancing, and they called it quarantine. We would call it stay at home today. Mm-hmm. That's pretty forward thinking. Why did that occur to them that would be the way to contain this?
They knew that the flu was spread through groups of people. They knew that it was spread through these droplets. So they were trying to keep the number of large groups down. But what's fascinating to me was that while they closed schools, while they closed churches and businesses, they also recognized that there was a need for farming. Because all of the able-bodied men were off fighting.
Mm-hmm.
So they kept the kids home from school to keep them healthy, but then they encouraged the students and teachers, who they called being idle at the time, to go out into the cotton fields or tobacco fields and work beside, they just worked together. They had competitions to see who could pick the most cotton. So they kept them home, but then they sent them out together in the fields.
And what was the end result of that? Did that cause this to be worse than it could have been if they just stayed home?
There was never anything traced directly to field work, but you did start to see spikes again in November and December.
Now,
so every
time
they, yeah.
Well, you mentioned that the governor could not, he felt he didn't have the power to say you must, he couldn't enforce a stay at home
right.
regularly. He didn't have the resources to do that. So who made these decisions? Was this the mayor of Charlotte, the city council of Charlotte, the county commission of Mecklenburg County? Who made the decision to put these people in quarantine, essentially, and close all these businesses?
It was usually the mayor working with the Board of Health, following their recommendations.
That would have been Mayor McNinch of the mm-hmm. famous McNinch House here in Charlotte.
Mm-hmm.
Today, we have this impatience for a vaccine because we know that's the only way we're going to really conquer this, despite our lack of trust in science and scientists. We're waiting for science and scientists to come up with a vaccine. They are our best hope here. In 1918, did the world expect anything extraordinary out of medicine or doctors or scientists to save them from this?
No. They knew that, like every flu, it would eventually go away. And it did. But they were patient. They knew it had to play its course.
But it lasted a long time. And I know it was a different virus in the end than what it was in the beginning. But from the middle of 1918 to the end of 1920 mm-hmm. is a long time.
Yes.
What was the reaction of people when the mayor said businesses have to close? No more movie theaters. We're shutting the doors. You have to stay home. What was the reaction of folks?
I think initially it might have been a slight bit of relief. Maybe now, like now, people knew that that's how it would spread. But honestly, within a couple of weeks, a week or two, they started getting agitated.
Yeah.
Which that's the same as today, really.
You share the reporting of the Charlotte News and Evening Chronicle Society column, the Society column, on October the 1st, which noted a single case of the virus. The next day, October the 2nd, the paper reported 50 new cases of the virus. By October 3rd, the day after that, the paper reports up to 175 cases of the flu. This sounds very much like the facts and figures we were giving out here on this program with regard to the COVID-19 virus. It just multiplied and multiplied mm-hmm. and multiplied exponentially. But the city fathers, this was back in October. When did they enact this quarantine? How long did it take them to get around to it?
They would have enacted some kind of measures by the beginning of that second week, maybe the second week of October. They were starting. They were hesitant. I know that for a few days they were saying that no quarantine was on the horizon, but by I think maybe the 7th, all of a sudden it just appeared. They said as of 6 p.m. last night, city was on lockdown.
Were they doing this in other towns and cities around North Carolina and in South Carolina? I mean, you may not know about South Carolina, but were they doing this everywhere?
Yes. Yep. Schools were shut down. Lenore shut down schools for the remainder of the school year.
And this was back in October.
So they shut them down because people were fighting it, but they shut them down, I believe, in November or just early December for the rest of the year.
Well, businesses, at least later on in this pandemic in 1918, 1919, would come to protest these closings, and we're going to talk about that when we come back. Dr. Lauren Austin is our guest. She's written a doctoral dissertation just 2 years ago called Afraid to Breathe, Understanding North Carolina's Experience of the 1918-1919 Influenza Pandemic at the State, Local, and Individual Levels, and we will continue in just a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Dr. Lauren Austin is our guest today. She wrote a doctoral dissertation just 2 years ago before COVID-19 was even in our minds at all. We didn't even think it was going to, we never thought that something like this could happen, even though scientists did and tried to warn us. But her dissertation is called Afraid to Breathe, and it's all about the 1918-1919 influenza pandemic in North Carolina at the state, local, and individual levels, because she did some reporting by looking at letters that people wrote in 1918-1919. Did the closings that we've talked about back in 1918, which happened very quickly, they closed businesses, they closed schools, they closed churches, they closed movie theaters. I'm not sure how many movie theaters were in Charlotte, maybe two, one back then, but they closed them very quickly. Did the closings back then lead to the kind of hardships, or was it worse then than it was that we're experiencing today for people, for individuals?
It may have been worse because most of those businesses were local, locally owned by individuals. And all of a sudden those people had no income. That's why.
And no social security net.
Right.
Right.
Right. No government bailouts, no net at all. That's why I think a lot of people quickly grew tired of the quarantine measures and started to push back against them. You had schools and businesses being pushed to reopen, businesses largely because the holiday season was coming up. People wanted to have parties. They wanted to go shopping.
Yeah, businesses ultimately sued the local Department of Health, at least here in the Charlotte region, to open because they couldn't make a profit. Were they successful in that effort?
No. No, they weren't. The judge did not buy that. They said that the Board of Health had no intention to restrict their profit. It was more for the good of public health. So
how long did it take between the time they closed the businesses for businesses to ultimately reopen?
They started reopening things in December ahead of the holiday season. A lot of people thought that was a bad idea, but businesses were getting very agitated. They didn't want to miss that holiday traffic.
Well, there's a lot of talk right now about opening business because we can't keep this going. We have to get the economy going again, and the repercussions of this are we are witnessing in real time right now. The oil industry is being decimated by this, and the automobile industry is being hurt by this, and live theater is being hurt by this, and you can just go down the list. And how the octopus arms from all of this are entangled and spread out, it's going to be very difficult to recover, and more difficult the longer we wait. So the concern is that if we do it too soon, it's going to cause a resurgence of this virus, and more people will die than could have had we just stuck to our guns. That was the same concern back then.
So it was.
When they reopened, did they experience a resurgence? Because they reopened in what, 1918? Mm-hmm. And this went to 1920.
You did see a lot of peaks in December due to reopenings. A lot of schools went back in late November, early December, or even early November. They would open the schools and they would have to close them again by mid-November for a couple of weeks. And what I saw was a lot of cyclical closing and reopening through March.
And what did that do to their psychology, to the of what they were thinking in their minds? This thing, every time we try to get to take a step ahead, we have to take a step back. So what does that do to somebody? How did they react to that?
The reaction to it was fascinating. A lot of researchers have thought that it was lumped in with World War I. And just kind of looked at as one big event. But what I found was that the government was loudly telling people that this is something that we have to deal with on the home front and be thankful that you aren't all fighting a war. And when the soldiers come back, you don't need to complain about anything. They were encouraged to not talk about it once the war ended and the soldiers started coming back.
Are those the mixed messages that you talk about that were being sent out by government? Today we're being told that mixed messages are being sent out by the White House, but the same thing happened in a different way back then. On the one hand, government officials were saying, stay home, don't go out, don't shop, we're closing everything down. On the other hand, go out and vote. Because it was an election year. Go out and vote. You're safe if you go out and vote. What were they thinking?
They even told people to stop having silly fears about infection at the polls and to just go out and vote, which it was in direct contrast to the health measures they were suggesting. And I think that confusion caused people to just do what they normally would do in many cases.
And because there was a war on, they told people essentially to buck up, suck it up, and suffer through it because the boys overseas have it worse than you do.
Exactly.
That's another kind of mixed message. The first paragraph of your dissertation is pretty grim. I'm going to read it. It says, it's not uncommon, you say, that bodies should be piled from floor to ceiling, morgues should be overflowing, and streets should be filled with corpses when a country is in the midst of fighting a world war. However, it is uncommon to see bodies spread everywhere when the country in question is thousands of miles away from the nearest battleground. This sight was almost universal in the fall and winter of 1918-1919. It was that bad?
It was that bad. You had facilities and morgues that weren't prepared for that amount of death. People remembered seeing caskets piled floor to ceiling at the station outside of Camp Green in Charlotte. And you had morgues even in Philadelphia, and they were just packed, rooms packed. They didn't have any way to take care of the bodies that were resulting from the spread.
One of the things we're talking about today with the closing of the schools, even though we have online education, something that they didn't have then, is the backsliding that young people generally experience over the summer. They know a lot of stuff in the spring when they leave school. When they come back, they have to do remedial education because they forgot. They haven't thought about it. They've forgotten a lot of it. And for places like Lenore in 1918 that closed their schools from October or so on to the end of the school year, talk, that's a loss of a whole year of education. How did people deal with that back then? Or was that just not as important back then as it is today?
It was still important. A lot of parents were very angry that their children would be losing an entire year of education.
Yeah.
They really fought back against the Board of Education for that decision. But ultimately, Lenore was more concerned about the health. They knew that the kids could make it to work.
Did they have a better outcome in Lenore because of that? Was it a lesser of an impact on them?
They did. They fared a little better. You still had, it wasn't just the schools. You still had places like Mills that were hotspots of the spread. So you could close down one, but you know, one could pop up elsewhere. But Lenore tended to fare fairly well.
The economy was different back then, and it wasn't probably as, it certainly wasn't as worldwide interconnected as it is today. But what was the recovery from this like, economically speaking? Did it take a long time to recover from the pandemic?
I didn't really look at that, but I think that you had things opening, reopening and closing intermittently. A lot of the mills were closed, but they were reopening, you know, December, January to get back to it. And if they had to close again for a week to kind of stop the spread, they would do that. But I saw a lot more intermittent closing than long-term closing in most cases.
Some people were more affected, as they are today, by flus and by the COVID-19. Some were more affected than others. They would get it and they would recover quickly, or their symptoms were milder than others, or and others would die, as you say. They'd get it in the morning and by nightfall they would be dead. But one of the things you say I'd never heard about, and that's in this 1918 flu, is for some people, when they recovered, their personalities had changed forever. Mm-hmm. And one of those people was President Woodrow Wilson.
Yes.
How did it change his personality?
I had never heard this before, so I was really interested in it. But he came down with the flu during the peace talks for World War One, and when he went in initially, he was very supportive of Germany. He thought that the, you know, the restrictions against them shouldn't be that harsh. He was a proponent for being a little more lenient on them. But when he came down with the flu, when he came back, he was gone from the table for a few days. But when he came back, he had lost that fire. He agreed to the more strict reparations, and Germany lost their support.
Yeah,
a lot of people think that's World War II.
Yeah, it led to World War II. You had access to people's, you had access to newspaper clippings, but most importantly, you had access to people's letters. People don't like write letters anymore, and I'm sure that 100 years from now, our emails, although they're being stored on a server someplace, may or may not be available. Who knows? What did having access to letters allow you to do?
It allowed me to see how people really thought, because you are more willing to speak the truth to loved ones in private than you are to put online or on Facebook. So it, I think that gives a window, a more personal look at how people really felt, because those people didn't think their letters were ever going to end up in an archive somewhere.
Right.
Who thinks that? So they were speaking the truth.
So correct me if I'm wrong, but as I read through your material, that it seemed that the death toll in North Carolina from the 1918 flu was much, much, much worse than it has been with the coronavirus. 13,700 people died in North Carolina alone from October 1918 through March 1919, March 1st, 1919.
Mm-hmm.
How should we react to that? Are we overreacting? In other words, if we are doing what they did in 1918 by closing businesses and schools and movie theaters and restaurants, when they're facing a death toll of 13,000, are we overreacting today?
I don't think we're overreacting. I think we're being proactive, because you never know how a population is going to react to an outbreak like that. So if we hadn't closed, I don't know what the outbreak would have been like. And I think maybe part of North Carolina's 13,000 deaths were due to the opening and reclosing cycle that went on for those few months that maybe going, if they had just held out a little longer.
Going back too soon may have raised the death toll. In 1918, the North Carolina death toll was higher than the national rate. We experienced 325 deaths per 100,000 people. Nationally, the number was only 299 per 100,000 people. Do we know why we had higher numbers?
Well, certainly our initial health situation did not help matters. The loss of life that we actually suffered during that pandemic sparked a statewide change in our approach to health measures.
Really?
It caused more hospitals to be built and more standardization to occur.
And it's another striking parallel. We are discovering that African Americans today are dying at greater numbers and being infected in greater numbers by the COVID-19 virus than white people. Mm-hmm. The same was true in 1918, and the same reasons are true. Slightly different, I suppose, degrees, but the same reasons. Lack of access to health care, poverty, lack of education, and other elements. So when they improved the health care system from 1918 onward because of this, they didn't take that into consideration? Did they even know that? Was it even a factor in their knowledge base?
I don't think they factored that in. I think they were trying to just in general spread, because back then hospitals were places for the less wealthy to go. If you had means, you had a doctor come to you. So they had to change the view of hospitals as being places for poor people and change it to places where you could go for help.
And you know that the numbers were higher among the black population because of death certificates? Is that how you found that out?
Yes, yes.
Toward the end of your dissertation, you say it's impossible to know from where the next pandemic will come, but it is almost certain that living in a world with four times the number of inhabitants than it had in 1918, with millions of people, pigs, poultry, living close together, every corner of the world easily accessible to any other point within hours, with American hospitals stocking no more than a few days' supply of most life-saving drugs, and the majority of drugs being manufactured abroad, we are at once both wholly unprepared and ideally situated for another influenza outbreak. Now, COVID-19 is not the flu, but how do these words make you feel today?
I did write them. I didn't know they would be relevant quite so soon, unfortunately. Scientists have been saying for a long time that we were due for another pandemic. They weren't sure if it was the flu, if it would be some type of coronavirus, but they knew that something like this tends to pop up about every 100 years for some reason. So they knew that something was coming. And you can say that people warned about a pandemic years ago and that people didn't listen, but that's not really true, because you can be warned that something is coming, but when you're told it's coming, but you don't know what it looks like, you don't know what shape it's going to take or what it's going to be, how can you prepare?
Your entire dissertation, all 300 pages of it, is available online if people want to access it. If they were to access it, what would it change their thinking about what's happening right now with COVID-19 in 10 seconds or less?
It might teach them to be a little bit more patient with quarantine measures, because they're not trying to keep you from anything. They're trying to keep you healthy.
Dr. Lauren Alston's dissertation is called Afraid to Breathe, Understanding North Carolina's Experience of the 1918-1919 Influenza Pandemic at the State, Local, and Individual Levels. She joined us in April of last year to discuss her work. Thanks for listening, and stay safe. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.